Hello and welcome to Bone Up, the podcast all about bones, how we make them, why we break them, and if we fully understand them. I'm David Armstrong.
Hi, and I'm Richie Abel. And over this series, we're going to be exploring osteoporosis, bones, what we know and what we're yet to discover. And we hope you will join us on the journey.
So for anyone keen to learn more about our infrastructure of calcified collagen, this is Bone Up. So welcome back to episode 2 of Bone Up Live, recorded here in Innsbruck at the ECTS. We're looking forward to bringing you some more interviews.
Listeners, we're very pleased to announce our next guest, Professor John Carey, who's the clinical lead for DEXA Fracture Liaison Services and Osteoporosis Services at Galway University Hospital. Thank you for joining us, John.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to speak to you. We've had to come all the way to Innsbruck to talk to each other.
That's right.
We live in the same island.
So we'd like to ask you about the talk you've given at ECTS on the best use of DEXA for taking care of patients. How do you feel DEXA is best used?
Super. So I suppose fundamentally, just so the general public understand, DEXA is a test. And like any test, if it's used appropriately and correctly for the right people, it provides extraordinarily useful information. For anybody with a bone problem, DEXA is an essential service. Without having DEXA, you can't run an osteoporosis service. Unfortunately, for some reason, people seem to think in osteoporosis, you don't necessarily need all these extra tests, but it's not an extra test, it's an essential test. For people who've never had a fracture, it's used for predicting who'll most likely fracture. It's not a guarantee. It's a great way to assess people before they have a fracture. And a fracture is the medical word for a broken bone. Patients are often confused. They'll tell you, I didn't have a broken bone, I just had a fracture. I didn't have surgery, I just had a procedure on my back. So it's important they understand that DEXA is just a test. Once people have a broken bone or a fracture, that is diagnostic of osteoporosis. That's like having a heart attack and having a cholesterol test to see if you're at risk. So by the same juncture, once your bone breaks, that means you have osteoporosis. So DEXA is no longer for diagnosis. In people who haven't had a fracture, we can also use DEXA to categorize people of having osteoporotic BMD or not. But a lot of people who fracture or break a bone won't meet that threshold. So that means, in science terms, they have a false negative test if they break a bone and the test didn't show it. On the other hand, if you test the wrong people and lots of young, healthy people, you'll get false positive tests where people had a test that they probably shouldn't have done because they're not at risk for a fracture in the immediate future. And they may show up as, quote unquote, having a positive test when in reality, that's probably a false positive because they don't have the disease. And there are many other complex reasons why that takes place, but in simple terms. And I suppose in terms of what we discussed briefly today, if people have a fracture and they've low bone density, by the DEXA test, they're much more likely to have another fracture than if they just have low bone density or they just have the fracture. And the final thing that sometimes people don't understand is once you've made the diagnosis, DEXA is still essential, but it's not for diagnosis because we have that diagnosis. It's what it's being used for is for monitoring your treatment or your response to treatment. Because some people, like every disease, will respond really well. Some people respond, oh, you're okay, not perfectly or brilliantly, but we're happy with it. Unfortunately, like every disease, not everybody responds to treatment. So the only way to really know if people are responding is to follow up bone density tests or to see if they have further fractures. There are other ways to assess that, but they would be the main fundamental tools we have in an osteoporosis service today.
One of the issues we see with DEXA scans, as you say, is sometimes they're not well interpreted because people don't know what question they're answering. What are the sort of common pitfalls in interpreting DEXAs, or that you see DEXAs interpreted incorrectly? I'll throw you one. Someone's been told their bone density is normal because their T-score is +2 at the lumbar spine. Then you and I look at the lumbar spine and there's scoliosis and degenerative chains. And so what are the other sort of pitfalls that a GP or a radiographer should look for when they're getting a DEXA scan?
Yeah, so the common things are, what was the first thing actually is who is being scanned and why? Mm-hmm. And that's sometimes something people don't understand. If the patient was being scanned, say, to assess the risk of fracture, the report should say this patient's low risk, intermediate risk, or high risk, but it may not. It's not for monitoring treatment. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if they've had five fractures, it's not for diagnosis. So that's a common mistake we see, where the patient's told they don't have osteoporosis, they have osteopenia because they had a fracture, but the test didn't show osteoporosis. So that's probably one of the commonest problems we see. Other common problems, as you say, sometimes there are other imaging artifacts that pop up that are ignored, like the patient's had spine surgery and the bone density has gone up 80% because they've had a spinal fusion, but nobody actually looked at the image to see there's metalwork. There are sometimes, and I'm sure you see this just like I do, people have had multiple spine fractures since the last DEXA, yeah. And it looks like the BMD has gone up, but the bone is broken. That's why.
And someone then stops their drug, even though they've now had three extra fractures because their bone density has improved.
Exactly.
But it's a lack of understanding of what the scan actually shows, isn't it?
That's correct. And DEXA is a much more complex test than any other test in radiology because, unlike, say, a chest X-ray, DEXA has an electronic medical record. So it captures information like risk factors, your demographics, the treatments you're on, which is more than you would get, say, in a regular radiology report. On top of that, you also have images, which you might have, say, for a chest X-ray or a CT scan. But in addition to that, you also have measurements like bone mineral density, like fat mass, lean mass, or vascular calcification. And you may also get a VFA scan, which often picks up spine fractures that were previously undiagnosed. So there's a lot more complexity and clinical information and other information with a DEXA scan than you would have with something like maybe an ultrasound or an X-ray or a CT. So there's a kind of myth out there that DEXA, oh, it's just pressing buttons and it's just bone density, but it's anything but. So really, the bone density is the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more information below the surface. And if it's used really well, like any test, it's very useful information and it's critically important to patient care. So, yeah, it's something that doesn't get enough emphasis. It's hard to get good at DEXA. You can't get good in a few weeks. It takes months or years to really master DEXA. And we're still learning many years later.
So the radiologists then who look at the DEXA scans, do they tend to be specialists who look just at DEXA scans, or are they more general radiologists that see lots of different types of images?
So I'm going to couch this a little bit, because the best radiologists in the world at DEXA are obviously brilliant at this, and then there are other people who have no training in DEXA, mm-hmm. just like in rheumatology, endocrinology, or any other specialty. So unfortunately, in general radiology training, a lot of radiologists have, I would say, fairly limited training in musculoskeletal radiology. So whether it's an MRI, a CT, yeah. or a DEXA scan, it's not their main field. And we see this, and it's reflected in the literature, as well as in our own country in Ireland, where a lot of the spine fractures are not picked up, whether it's an MRI, a CT, or an X-ray. When it comes to DEXA, DEXA is not part of general radiology training, or indeed musculoskeletal radiology training in most countries in the world today. It should be, and it can be, but it isn't. So unless there's a radiologist who's really interested in DEXA or osteoporosis or metabolic bone disease as a specialty, or the DEXAs are in a radiology department where they do a lot of training and teaching at DEXA, it's often not part of what they've been trained in or they're knowledgeable about. In fact, a lot of them may have very little knowledge in osteoporosis or other diseases as well. So, and sadly, what you see is sometimes some poor radiologist who's a great person and a nice person might be trained in cardiovascular imaging and has suddenly landed with, now you have to report all these DEXA scans. They've no training, they've no knowledge or access to what it is they should be looking for and how they should be reporting it. And I suppose part of our mission with the ECTS, with ISCD and IOF and other organizations, which we now have with lots of radiology societies, there's now endorsed positions, endorsed by the European Radiology Society, the European Skeletal Radiology Society, the Radiology Society in North America, and the Nuclear Medicine Societies in Europe and North America, which have all endorsed these positions, that we do need to have standards, we do need to endorse best practice. And the radiologists, just like everybody else, should be given the training and the opportunities to train and learn and audit and improve as they go forward.
You often find the DEXA department's almost separate from radiology, isn't it? The radiologists don't take that much connection with it. It's the DEXA radiographer who does it and runs it. That's certainly my experience. And
that's right.
Some excellent DEXA radiographers in my trust, and most of the radiologists don't take that much to do with it, really, which strikes patients as odd, I think. But
Well, that's correct. And I suppose there's three reasons for it. I think in medicine, we'll all do what we're comfortable doing.
Yeah.
And if I was asked to do open heart surgery tomorrow, that'd probably be the last thing on the hit list before I go home for the weekend. And I can understand if the radiologist is asked 20 years later with no training, you have to report this DEXA, and they're asked about drugs they've never heard of. Like, I don't think that's fair, and I don't think it's appropriate. But we always say in DEXA, there's no I in team, and DEXA is probably the number one team sport in musculoskeletal imaging. It needs a really well-trained and expert radiographer and our nurse. It needs the clinician who's prescribing the drugs and seeing the patients. It needs the radiologist who's an expert in imaging and fractures. And it's everybody working together. And you see what in the best centres in the world where they've really cracked this is where everybody's working together as part of the team. The people who see the patients, the people who prescribe the treatment, the people who operate on the patients, the fracture liaison services, everybody's as part of the same team. And we can all learn from each other.
That's really heartening to see people trying to come together, provide the best care, provide holistic care, reach out to their colleagues and bring everybody together.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And I suppose that's what keeps us going, right? You know, at the end of the day, unfortunately in life, when people get sick, we can't be successful all the time. We won't get it right. And perfect is the enemy of good. But we can be better and we can improve and we can always learn from others and we can always help each other out. And, you know, if you talk to a lot of smart people, you get a lot of smart solutions. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the problem we had 10 years ago and the solution we had was very appropriate back then, but it's no longer the solution, or the problem may have changed. A good example would be, you know, we never really saw problems when people discontinued treatment 10 years ago, other than, well, if you don't take your treatment, it doesn't work. But in the last 10, 15 years, we've seen a problem with one of our new drugs where it's a really good drug and it's a fantastic treatment for the most appropriate people. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, what we've seen sometimes is people were treated inappropriately, they've stopped it, and when they stop it, they have this rebound effect, more like an elastic band shooting back than, say, the brakes in a car. And some people have had catastrophic bone loss and fractures. And that's something new we've had to deal with. So, and in DEXA, there's many new extra pieces of software and variables and better image quality than we would have had, say, even 15 years ago. And that's changed things. We can see fractures easier. We can see vascular calcification. We have better ways to assess bone quality. So things are evolving. Things are improving. And that's why we need meetings like ECTS and updates and talk to colleagues so we can stay abreast of what's happening in our field.
And then, like you say, working across the other societies as well, especially the radiologists. I think listeners at home would be happy to hear how much goes on behind the scenes to pull everybody together.
So if you had €1 million, and I'm not giving you €1 million because our podcast really doesn't pay for interviews, and you could choose to buy more DEXA scanners, or you could choose to put that into educating people better on how to interpret a scan, or you could use it in some other part of your fracture liaison service, where would you put the money?
I would put the money in DEXA education.
In education, not in more scanners?
That's right.
Yeah.
We have enough DEXA scanners in the Western world, I think. Mm-hmm. They're sometimes in the wrong place. They're sometimes in the right place. But the fundamental problem in healthcare, not just osteoporosis care around the world today, is waste. And we see GDP is going up at X rate in every country around the world. It's different by country to country. But healthcare is far outstripping the rise in GDP. So, and new technology is wonderful. It's not just in osteoporosis. We're seeing lots of really interesting, nice pictures, science, but something that's maybe not very helpful clinically, and vast sums of money being spent on this new technology. And yes, we have this really good test, which is very cheap, extraordinarily cost-effective, and life-saving or life-altering for patients, and we're not using it very well. So I would put the money in making sure everybody has very good foundations in clinical densitometry. That will save money, and that will save lives, and that will be a much better investment in the future of our people.
Yeah, so people know what to do with the information that they're getting, because I'm sure like me, you see people, they've been told they have osteoporosis and a DEXA, their T-score is minus 2.5, but as you say, they don't need treatment. And there's people on the other side of the fence who have multiple fractures, but they've been told they don't have osteoporosis because their T-score is minus 2.4 and they're not getting treatment. And the DEXA is not the problem, it's the interpretation, it's the person ordering the result, getting the result back, and knowing what to do with it then.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, so we've done a very conservative estimate around quality DEXA in Ireland. And just so the listeners are aware, we've been teaching best practice DEXA courses in Ireland since 2009, across the board, from paediatrics to adult to body composition. And yet today, a conservative estimate that we have come up with, we're working with the ECTS on this, is that about if 1% of the DEXAs resulted in the harm that we're seeing from poor quality DEXAs, that outstrips the annual cost of providing DEXA services alone. That's about 100 million a year wasted in Ireland. Wow. And we're seeing that every day. And we've written to the government and we've written to the administrators, but they're not listening. We know from the literature that DEXA errors are more in the range of 20 to 50% of scans. Now, thankfully, a lot of those are minor errors, but there are major errors happening all the time. Like, as you say, people are told they don't have osteoporosis, even though they've had multiple fractures. And on the other hand, somebody who had a scan because they're worried about their bones, who probably has very healthy bones, but they're small, yeah, or there's something else that just makes the bone density look a little bit abnormal when really it's probably normal for them. You, and I tell patients, you wouldn't say you're normal because you have brown eyes and abnormal because you have blue eyes. That's normal for you. And yeah, just so patients understand, the modern definition of normal is somebody who hasn't been examined properly. So if you do tests in people today with really sensitive testing equipment, you'll overdiagnose any condition. And there's really good evidence that we're overdiagnosing osteoporosis in younger, otherwise healthy people, and underdiagnosing it, which has been something we've all been working towards for a long time. And just so the listeners understand, the mortality, the morbidity, and the healthcare costs associated with osteoporotic fractures in Europe today are the same as cardiovascular disease and cancer. And yet, when you look at the funding and the support for those diseases, it vastly outstrips what we have for bone care. You saw multiple famous people like Ennio Morricone died of complications following a broken leg, but mm-hmm, nobody said he died from a hip fracture or he died from osteoporosis. Yeah. And yet, you know, Pelosi, I think, she had an accident and she had surgery recently, but nobody said she had osteoporosis and she had a hip fracture. And, you know, famous basketball player who did the fight scene with Bruce Lee back in the 1980s and still holds the NBA record for the highest scoring ever, mm-hmm, he fell and broke his hip. But the whole articles and all the newspapers say, well, he's got prostate cancer and he's getting prostate cancer treatment. But nobody said he had a hip fracture and osteoporosis from the prostate cancer treatment. And that's where it's missing. Mm-hmm. Everyone said the princess died of a broken heart. So non-medical people understand the heart's important. Princess died, but nobody said that father died from a broken back or the mother died from a broken hip. Yeah. And that's a gap we have to fill as educators.
And when you see it announced that a celebrity has declared they have some disease or other, you're sort of hoping it might be osteoporosis, but it never is.
Yeah, well, I don't know that we'd ever hope somebody has a disease.
No, that's the wrong way to say it.
But you're absolutely right.
You understand. It's
the
never...
Pope broke his hip and nothing happened. Ronald Reagan mm-hmm. broke his hip and nothing yeah. happened. So Queen Paola had two spine fractures and then she fell or broke her hip. And mm-hmm. I understand she wasn't on treatment for osteoporosis. But I think as osteoporosis experts, we have to explain this. And there's something lost in the messaging. And I think one of the great things I flagged today was, for the first time ever, 14 bone organizations around the world are involved in either the assessment, the imaging, or the management of bone are finally agreed, and we have a clear message for the rest of the world, because I think that's a game changer. If we all have different messages and the message is a bit confused, it's hard to get traction. If we're all on the same page and we're singing off the same hymn sheet and it's a clear, simple message mm-hmm. and easy for people to understand, then we're going to make progress.
From the science perspective, easy to put at the top of a grant application when you're trying to hit the reviewers hard with the importance of what you're doing. I feel that osteoporosis research loses out a lot to dementia, Alzheimer's, cancer, because people do see them as being more serious somehow.
That's right. And again, a lot of that is media communications. And I think as experts, it behooves us to get better at communicating the right messages and to work together to agree on what those messages should be.
It's absolutely brilliant that you're out there and you're fighting for your patients and fighting for patients everywhere. It's really wonderful. Thank you for coming to talk to us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure and appreciate your support for osteoporosis patients everywhere.
It's lovely. Thank you very much. We'll get the message out there.
Yeah. Welcome, listeners. We're really pleased to announce our next guest today. We have Professor Monet Zaidi from the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, where he's the endowed chair, the Professor of Clinical Medicine. He's Professor of Pharmacology and Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Translational Medicine. Welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's really great that you've made time. I heard your talk this morning. I think it was one of those presentations that will stay in your mind for a long time, because it was a subject I thought I knew something about, and you introduced a whole new area to talk about. I often tell my patients, I hope they listen, that when their estrogen levels fall at the menopause, their bone turnover goes up and they lose bone, and are thinking about this other hormone, FSH, is that it just rises and that doesn't mean anything very much. But you told a fantastic story this morning, and I'd love if you told some of it again now for us, just how important FSH is. What have you discovered about FSH and bone?
Thank you very much for the invitation. So the textbook has always told us exactly what you just said, in that estrogen falls, there's bone loss after the menopause, there is the onset of obesity, and there is some level of mental deterioration that occurs in some women. However, there's a phase in a woman's life which is very early, about 2 to 3 years prior to the last menstrual period, mm-hmm. in which you see significant amounts of bone loss, the onset of adiposity, and mild cognitive decline. Now, at this time, the very famous SWAN study, the study of women's health across nations, which was funded by the National Institutes on Aging in the United States, showed that during this time, estrogen levels can be relatively normal, whereas FSH levels, follicle stimulating hormone levels, are actually on the rise. And the reason why they're on the rise is to compensate for a failing ovary. Mm. So you do get estrogen that's relatively normal before it falls off, and FSH that's rising. So we thought that the bone loss, the adiposity, and the cognitive decline that occurs during this, what we call late perimenopause, mm-hmm. cannot conceivably be explained by estrogen.
Yeah. Mm.
And that at that time, the hypothesis was that an elevated FSH may play a role in the pathophysiology or the pathogenesis of these three conditions. Now, we were a bone group, so we started off with bone. Mm-hmm. And we found that, yes, there was clear effects of FSH on bone cells. So that, for example, if you took an osteoclast, which is a cell that removes old bone, and stick some FSH on it, it resorbs more bone. Mm. It lives longer, and there are more cells that are generated. Similarly, the osteoblast, the activity dampens if you expose it to FSH. And so we were able to prove it through some early genetic experiments where we took out 50% of FSH from a mouse by knocking out the gene. So one copy of the gene was knocked out, and we got a high bone mass phenotype, which was due to an elevated, a reduced resorption and an elevated bone formation. And then fast forward a number of years, we suddenly discovered that when we developed an antibody to FSH that blocks its action on the receptor for FSH, we found that these mice also lose body fat, which came as a surprise. We didn't believe it. We had it reconfirmed by a variety of other groups. But when it was confirmed, it was now two diseases that we could potentially treat with a single FSH blocking agent. Mm. So it took about 10 years for us to reach that conclusion from where we started in early 2003, following which we again serendipitously discovered that FSH was a direct regulator of cognition, that is, a memory, at least in the mouse model. And that could explain the 2 to 3-fold higher risk of Alzheimer's in postmenopausal women, the faster rate of progression, and very much more importantly, the higher symptom burden, which has never really been related to estrogen, because there have been clinical trials where estrogen has been utilized in these women with very mixed results. Yeah. Notably, there's either been improvement or no change or even a reduction in memory. So we think that FSH could be a target in postmenopausal women for the prevention of these three conditions which affect millions of women worldwide.
So it's not that the estrogen's not having effect. We still believe the estrogen levels falling do have an effect on bone, but it's the other hormone produced by the pituitary gland that goes up. we've now you're saying that it actually has an effect as
right.
well.
So yeah. it is a composite. We have never said that estrogen does not have a role.
Yeah.
Reduced estrogen has a role. Estrogen is clearly a bone protective hormone. So I think it's a mix of the two that happens, and that's why women keep losing bone, because yeah. FSH is high, estrogen then lowers, and so there's a dual effect.
If I give my patient what we call HRT, I think
yes.
in America you call it NHT, if I replace the estrogen,
yes.
do I need to not worry, the FSH falls, I'm happy, or would I like to give them your FSH blocker that you're talking about as well?
That's very important. So in late menopause, later in the years of menopause, hormone replacement therapy or estrogen replacement therapy has been widely utilized. Mm-hmm. And the Women's Health Initiative showed that it clearly has an effect on fracture risk. Mm-hmm. Now, the mechanism is perhaps both direct and indirect. Mm-hmm. Directly, it would act on bone cells
yeah.
to prevent the osteoclast from removing bone. But it also suppresses through a feedback FSH levels.
Yeah.
And there have been some very small studies that have documented that the extent of FSH suppression relates to the extent of bone protection. Now, that is a hard tease out. So in a lot of women, when you give them estrogen, and we've seen that in clinical practice, both you and I have seen that, FSH levels don't fall.
Yeah, that's right.
And that probably relates to the duration of the elevated FSH. In some patients, it does fall. And there has to be a larger study where those correlations need to be established. So where does this potential therapeutic that we now have as a monoclonal antibody, which is humanized and should go into clinical trials in the next 9 months or so in a phase 1 clinical trial, which is against a very well-defined portion of the molecule that's FSH that binds to its receptor. And so it blocks the entry of FSH into its receptor. This should be used as a prevention, ideally, mm-hmm. for postmenopausal bone loss, visceral adiposity, and early memory loss. Because once these things set in, it's hard to get them back again.
Yeah, that's incredible. What a wonderful treatment that could be. Preventing decline in 3 chronic diseases all at the same time.
It is admittedly an ambitious goal. Even if one works, it's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
our best mouse data, though, quite interestingly, is an Alzheimer's disease.
That's interesting.
I mean, there's a very clear protection of memory loss, as I showed you. I had a little movie, but the thing won't work otherwise.
It did work later on after you moved on. It did start to work, so you could see that. Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. In that case, there was a mouse that went around in circles, and
yeah.
there was a mouse that went to the platform and just stayed there.
Yeah, you could see. And maybe I missed this bit. So are there FSH receptors in neural tissue in the brain, or how do we believe that has a direct effect on cognitive function?
So there are a couple of areas which regulate memory, one of which is the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus.
Mm-hmm.
And the granular cell layer is what is really regulating hippocampal-dependent memory, such as, for example, spatial or even recognition memory. There are other areas in the brain, such as cortical areas, infrarhinal cortex in particular, and honestly, I'm learning neuroscience as we go along.
Yeah.
These two areas are critical for memory functions. Interestingly, the FSH receptor exists in these areas at fairly high levels.
Oh.
And that's why we think that it is a real phenomenon in terms of the expression of these receptors. Now, the FSH receptors in other regions of the brain as well. And if you map out the mouse brain, you see that FSH receptors are there in over 300 regions of the mouse brain. Their function is pretty unclear at this point of time.
How long will it be before you start to get the results from the phase 1 trial?
So we opted to do our clinical trial in Liverpool, England, as opposed to the United States. And we're working very closely with Professor Richard Fitzgerald, who is a top-tier clinical trialist and really specializes in phase one early clinical trials. We've known each other now. He's been a part of our meetings. And once we get the antibody manufactured to a clinical grade, which we've just about started doing, that take about 9 months, and we've got to do some formal toxicology. So in about 9 to 12 months, we should, if we are lucky, get the first patient injected.
Wow, that's really exciting. I suppose the other just question came into my mind, and I know I mentioned it to you earlier, men produce FSH as well. And I don't want to muddy the waters, is potentially, is this a treatment for male patients as well, or are the FSH levels too low in men for
it to be? No, the FSH is produced by males.
Yeah.
It rises by about 3.5% a year. It is a molecule that is involved in the production of sperms.
Yeah.
So it could be a molecule that is used for reducing sperm numbers, but we haven't actually checked that. The antibody could be utilized for that purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
In males, if it is driven, if the bone loss or the memory loss or indeed the weight gain is driven by FSH, and there are certain conditions where it could be driven by FSH. For example, I showed some data from Denmark where the testes were taken out because of prostate cancer to reduce testosterone levels, and in that situation, an antibody against FSH could be utilized to prevent that bone loss. So if the FSH is rising or it drives these conditions, that's when it's going to be used maximally.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I get more referrals from my oncology colleagues now treating men with prostate cancer who then turn up with osteoporosis or fractures, and sometimes the options are limited. So potentially that's a very exciting new pathway, a new area.
Now they're using GnRH agonists rather than orchiectomy. At least in the United States, we don't do orchiectomy.
No, it's very little orchiectomy. Yeah.
But in certain parts of the world, it is done, and that's how an antibody such as this could be utilized in males.
The talk you gave today was absolutely fascinating, and you told it very well, and you explained the story. It's amazing that in your career you've been able to go from doing basic science, asking questions about how the body works, through to developing an antibody and getting ready to test it in people.
Right. So this was actually a transformational concept, which was, you know, when you make these new discoveries, when you come up with something new, there's always a pushback. And so we had a lot of pushback from the estrogen world in the case of TSH, from the thyroid world. But we left it for other people to confirm. And I think that a lot of people have confirmed these findings. I showed some of that, how these findings were confirmed. And so the physiology, I think, is fairly well worked out. The second issue was, how do we use this phenomenon to base a therapeutic upon, which we established the concept using mouse work, mouse polyclonal, and then mouse monoclonal antibodies. And then there was the fork on the road. Do I go and align myself with pharmaceutical industry or with biotechnology folks, or create a spin-off and, you know, raise money from venture and get taken over? The choice that we collectively made and my team made was to do it ourselves, which is actually very rare. The level that we've gone to is very rare in an academic medical center to happen.
Yeah.
And so we developed a platform which was highly rigorous, which was fully transparent, that the FDA could come and inspect. We recruited consultants who have worked in the pharmaceutical industry in various domains, for example, pharmacology, toxicology, CMC, which relates to manufacturing, and IND submissions, that's the investigational new drug submissions to the FDA and to the MHRA in this case in England. And so we created a platform where we could produce data without going to a CRO or without giving the stuff away to pharma or to biotech at that early stage, because we were concerned that if we do that, there is the odd chance that it could be shelved. Yeah. And since we had made the discovery, we were passionate to get this into people. And I think that realization would hopefully come true.
It's to your enormous credit, I think, the way that you did that. And I mean, not only is the work that you have done superb, but I think the way you presented it and the way you told the story this morning was a textbook example of how you should do a presentation at a conference like this. It was really excellent and inspiring and logical, and I think it's to your great credit the way you've taken this through.
Yeah, I wanted the younger generation to understand how to move this along and not to give up. I mean, as you would imagine, we had bumps in the way. Yeah. And everything is bumps in the way. And so the entire portfolio, including, for example, if you have to inject an antibody into people, you have to have it formulated.
Yeah.
If I give it to a CRO to get it formulated, it would cost $1 million.
Yeah.
We did that ourselves because I recruited a formulation guy, and he created 217, I believe it was, combinations of excipients, a variety of molecules, to keep the antibody stable in solution. And now we have evidence of thermal stability, of colloidal, monomeric, structural. It's a very stable solution to inject into people. So those kind of things take time and effort and reduce cost and keep it within your own domain so that you can actually keep a tab on it.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. We know you're really busy. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
It's been inspiring. I'm really excited to see the results of this work coming through.
Thank you.
We'll have to catch up with you and find out how it goes.
Absolutely. Always be available. Thanks.
Listeners, thank you for tuning in to episode 2 of Bone Up Live 2025. We hope you enjoyed it.
We have more live interviews coming in episode 3, which should be released soon. Bye now.